I am Dave Schrader, and my guest this evening, Sarah Whalen, for this next hour. We'll open up phone lines at the bottom of the hour if you have questions for my guest. Her book, Royal Vengeance, The Assassination of Princess Diana and the Ancient Royal Cult of Human Sacrifice. We have a few emails coming in. I'll throw at you one question here, Sarah. Will you please ask what Sarah finds was the cause of the accident, and can she elaborate on the two-hour span between the accident and the hospital, which you mentioned earlier? And that comes from Susan.
Okay. Well, there were many witnesses, and there were, in fact, three inquests. The last inquest was the most informative, although it was the latest in time, and it was largely done by the insistence of Muhammad Al-Fayed, whose son Dodi was, of course, killed in the car crash as well. And witnesses say that the Mercedes that Diana and Dodi were in left the back of the Ritz-Carlton, and there was a decoy car out front. So most of the paparazzi were looking at the decoy car, and Diana and Dodi left the Ritz from the rear and went around. Like I said, they would go to the Place de Concorde, which is the circle, and they would go around the arch to the right. Now, the Champs leads out to the far right there, and Dodi's apartment is at the end. It was thought that they didn't take the Champs because it was very crowded. It was summer. It was a late night, and so there was a lot of traffic. There was a lot of foot traffic. Instead, they were going to go farther up and take another exit off and take a parallel road. But as the Mercedes was coming around the Place de Concorde circle in that arc, it picked up behind it a dark sedan car that began immediately tailgating it. Also, five motorcycles surrounded the Mercedes, and these are not the scooters that are used by the paparazzi. These are not little motor scooters. These are very full-fledged big bike motorcycles, and the riders were wearing black leathers with black helmets that could not be identified. And witnesses say that there were two of these bikes at one point on both sides of Diana's Mercedes. And at one point, one of the motorbikes passed the Mercedes on the left very dangerously, pulled to the front. And all this takes place in a really short period of time. When they get to the entrance to the actual Alma Tunnel, there is a white Fiat Uno that is dawdling. It's going really slow and just poking around the front entrance of the Alma Tunnel. And there are only two lanes going down. The Fiat was riding very much in the middle. It began blocking the Mercedes. The Mercedes had already picked up speed, not so much to escape the paparazzi, but because the dark sedan was, when you tailgate a car, you often force the driver to go a bit faster. And so the car was speeding. It wasn't going hugely fast. It was going about 60 miles an hour, which is actually pretty typical for Paris traffic, and also typical for driving here. You know, most Americans do drive a bit fast. They may speed. They'll go 5, 10, 15 miles over the limit. They very seldom have a fatal accident because of that. What really caused the fatalities was the fact that no one in the car was wearing a seatbelt. And Princess Diana almost always wore a seatbelt. In every photo you see of her in her vehicle, even when she's got a beautiful gown and, you know, very elaborate jewelry on, she's usually got a seatbelt on. So the hypothesis is that the seatbelts must not have worked. Ordinarily, a bodyguard doesn't wear a seatbelt so that they can move quickly was in the car. So the one bodyguard who was with them, Trevor Reese Jones, on that night, he was not wearing a belt, but he's the only person who actually survived. He went through the windshield. He tore his face up terribly, but he's the only person who lived. Now, the sedan pushing the Mercedes forward it pushes into the Fiat. The Mercedes hits the Fiat. We know there's contact. The Fiat's going very slow. The Mercedes hit it. The rear lights of the Fiat broke and scattered on the roadway in the Alma. And meanwhile, the motorcycle has come around to the left and is now in front of the Mercedes. We know that at one point, the Fiat pulled back a little bit and scraped the right side of the Mercedes. They would have felt it very distinctly. It left a huge scrape, and it tore the side mirror off. It also impacted the right front wheel of the Mercedes and pushed it. Accident experts found this. They found the paint from the Fiat Uno on the Mercedes right front wheel. So it pushed it, and they can tell from the skid marks, it pushed the Mercedes into the 13th pillar of the Alma Tunnel. And that impact, without belts, going at 60 miles an hour, is what caused the fatalities. And if you notice, the people on the left side of the car, the driver, Henri Paul, and right behind him, Dodi Al-Fayed, the passenger, those two men are killed instantly. Their aortas are torn open. Their spines are broken in three places. They are instantly killed. Maybe 4 minutes, Dodi lives. That's a bleed out. Trevor Reese Jones is very cut. He's screaming. Princess Diana is still alive. She has a serious injury. It's a tear to her pulmonary vein, but it's much slower bleeding. It's a slow bleed, usually. And she was in excellent physical shape. She was relatively young. She survived that accident. She was awake, and she was talking. She was shook up. Her body was completely turned backwards by the G-forces, you know, but she... You could have picked her up out of the car. If you had picked her up, Dave, in your arms and just, you know, firemen carried her to the hospital, which was not even 3 miles away, she would have had a good chance of living. Between 50 and 85% chance of being able to have that tear sutured and surviving.
Well, why wouldn't they try to get her back then? What would be the hang up? We have to take a break. We'll find that out when we return right here on Coast to Coast AM. Ellen is our guest as we continue to talk about the death of Diana. Now, again, there's this gap. She's injured severely in this car. What is the official reasoning why they didn't rush her to the hospital, especially knowing that the other people in the car were dead? You know, one was ejected. What's going on with her? Why not get this beloved treasure to the hospital as soon as possible?
Right. They made a number of statements in the inquest, in the different inquests. First, they claimed not to have recognized her, which is ridiculous. I mean, she's one of the best known faces in the world. But even if you don't recognize that she's a VIP, you would still, I mean, it's a law in France to immediately render aid. But what they did was they rendered very insubstantial aid. I think the first doctor who attended her, he just put an oxygen mask on her face, and he claimed he didn't have his blood pressure cuff. The blood pressure cuff would have shown immediately that she had a serious internal injury, because when you're bleeding, when you have an internal bleed like that, it starts immediately affecting your blood pressure.
Where did this doctor come from?
He came out of the blue. Supposedly, he was driving with a friend from a party and going home, and he just happened to be in the tunnel. This is his story.
Well, that would explain why he wouldn't have the blood pressure cuff then.
Well, no, again, by law, if you are an emergency physician, you're required to carry your equipment with you.
Hmm.
And the car he drove was owned by the Emergency Medical Association. So it was very weird. He gave Frederick Maes, he gave a lot of very inconsistent statements throughout and outrightly lied. Look, in the United States, we scoop people up and we take them to the hospital immediately. There's something called the golden hour. And the theory of emergency medicine here is that if you can get someone to the hospital, if they're still alive, get them to the hospital within the first 60 minutes of the accident, you have a better than 50% chance of saving their life. So we scoop and run. The French stay and play. They have ambulances that are very well equipped, and they can do a lot for you in the ambulance. But the one thing they can't do is surgery, especially to repair a tear to the pulmonary vein. No doctor in an ambulance can do that. You need to be in an operating room. And like I said, the hospital was less than 3 miles away, and there were other hospitals that were better equipped that were even closer. So they chose a hospital that was, you know, the farthest away, and they chose a hospital that did not have a pulmonary surgeon on duty that night. And they kept saying that she had a head injury, which was simply hypothetical by, you know, the first responding doctor. There was, in fact, she was talking to people. She was talking, her eyes were open. At various points, she was conscious. And the first thing that Dr. Martino, the ambulance physician who finally arrived with equipment, the first thing he did was he intubated her so she couldn't talk anymore. And then he did exactly the opposite of what you do to someone who has a pulmonary tear and, you know, you would be taking them for surgery. He gave her medication that screwed up her blood pressure and would have made operation really much more difficult and complex. And then he just sat there. We didn't even take her out of the car. He let the French fireman cut the roof off the car to take out Trevor Rees-Jones, who was in the front. But like I said, with Diana, she was just sitting in the back seat. She was not trapped in the wreckage of the car at all. You could reach in and pick her up. You might have hurt her arm. She had an arm that was twisted up backwards, probably broken. But you would have had a much better chance of having her live had you just picked her up and walked. And even when they finally got her in the ambulance and it departed the tunnel, two reporters on a motor scooter followed because they wanted to see where it was going. They were paparazzi. And the ambulance was going so slowly, not even 5 miles an hour. It was going like 7 miles an hour. And they had to get off their scooter because, you know, the scooter engine kept cutting out. They had to walk the scooter next to the ambulance. And then when the ambulance was right across the street from the hospital, it stopped. And the reporters couldn't figure it out. And then they saw a man in a white coat. They presumed to be one of the doctors. He got out. He walked to the back. He opened the back doors, went inside, shut the doors. And then the ambulance started rocking ferociously back and forth. And they couldn't believe it. The assumption was that they were doing heart massage on her. But the inquest showed that that wasn't true. And initially, it was said that she had 3 heart attacks. But again, that's not true. At various times, her blood pressure would drop, especially in the position where she was in the car for a long time with her head down. And
could I ask, when you say it with authority like that, that just wasn't true, how do you know that wasn't true? What evidence do we have to point us in a different direction?
Because there were three inquests, and all the witnesses testified at these inquests repeatedly. And, you know, other doctors have analyzed the witnesses' testimony, and these are their conclusions.
All right. So what was going on then with all of the rocking? Was there any evidence to that?
I certainly do think that Dr. Martino is instrumental in causing her death. You have to ask whether this was just outrageous negligence on his part or whether he might have been paid to delay her arrival to the hospital. By the time she arrived at the hospital, she was dead. For all practical purposes, she was dead. They did open her. Her chest was filled with blood. All the blood in her body had literally drained into her chest. Mm. They were transfusing her. They took the heart out. They massaged it with their hands, trying to restore a rhythm. But they couldn't get the pressure to come up, and the heart would not beat. If you can imagine all the blood you have in your body suddenly collecting in your chest cavity, and it takes 2 hours for that to happen with a slow bleed. That is how she died. She did not have a heart attack. She did not have brain injury. She basically bled to death in the ambulance, and there's no rational reason for it. And initially, there were a bunch of lies told. And people, I guess, thought that, you know, no one would want to look too deeply. But Mohammed Al-Fayed kept hammering and hammering. And eventually, they had an inquest, which, frankly, it's not anywhere near up to American snuff. You know, if this had happened in the United States, there would be a huge inquest. Bank accounts would be examined. There would be discovery. People don't pussyfoot around here, and they understand more of what is at stake. They do not genuflect just because someone is the leader, as you can see with everybody's criticism of Trump. And, you know, criticism in general, people, we feel free to criticize our leadership. In England, criticizing the Queen is really fairly rare. And the Queen was not brought in to testify, even though Mohammed Al-Fayed, he had a theory of the case that, you know, the Queen didn't want Diana marrying Doty. I think it was certainly Doty's marriage to Diana would have really complicated things for the royal family. But I don't think that's why they killed her. I think, like I said before, they had hoped, they made a decision to do it earlier. And she gave them the opportunity by going on vacation, and she had dispensed with her police guard, and suddenly they had an opportunity in a place where, you know, she was not being handled in a regulated way. And so they jumped in and did it. And there were witnesses who saw a bright flash in the tunnel. They think that the motorcycle that went to the left around the Mercedes, they believe that there was a passenger on the back of that motorcycle who had a military-level strobe light. This is not like a paparazzi flash. This is a strobe. It's used in military actions to blind helicopter pilots and people like that at night. It's meant to disorient you so that, you know, you can be killed. And it certainly did disorient the driver. Many witnesses saw the flash. It's much discussed. The high point of the third inquest was they brought in Richard Tomlinson, who is a former MI6 agent, and he got into a lot of trouble. He wrote a book about his experiences. His book was not authorized, and he was accused of violating the Official Secrets Act. He basically, at the time, he was living in exile, I think, in Switzerland. And there was enormous pressure put on him. But he was Mohammed Al-Fayed's star witness. And he said that there had been a previous military plan to assassinate Milosevic. in a time.
All right, we have to cut off a break. We'll be back. We've got more coming your way with Sarah Whalen. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, on Coast to Coast AM. Thank you for joining me this evening. Our guest this evening, Sarah Whalen. We're going to start taking your phone calls in a few moments. Sarah, a quick question before we have to go back to break from Yoli in San Diego. Says, I'm not sure that I'm buying what this conspiracy is all about. How can she know such details, and why hasn't this information come to light earlier? How do you respond when you have the naysayers and the skeptics
well,
like this?
The information has come to light, but it's a lot of information. So when you have the information, and, you know, governments, I mean, an inquest is an official act of a government, and there was one done in France. The French inquest was mostly secret. There were a few things that were allowed out and a few comments made in French newspapers, but the French have a different kind of legal process. It's inquisitorial, and a lot of their proceedings are secret. But the second inquest was done by Scotland Yard, and it was so outrageously bad. I mean, there were several great books written by a guy named John Morgan. He's passed away, but he devoted the last years of his life to analyzing the Paget Report, which was Scotland Yard's inquest into the French accident. And there were so many flaws in it that this opened the door for Mohammed Al-Fayed to have what's called the Scott Baker inquest, which is the third and last inquest. But, you know, two things were going on. There was a lot of information. Some of it was hidden just because there was such a mountain. So it was very difficult to sift through everything. By this time, certain key witnesses had died. Others, their memory was not as sharp as it was when they first gave testimony. But, you know, there's enough consistency in there so that you can see pretty much what happened. And Mohammed Al-Fayed paid for Mike Mansfield, one of the top lawyers in London, to be his inquisitor at the third Scott Baker inquest. That being said, the third inquest still lacked the rigor of an American legal process. There was very little discovery. Things like bank accounts were not looked at. You know, the French had looked at some of Henri Paul's bank accounts because the issue was raised. I mean, he had large amounts of cash. He had a lot of money. The French focus was to try to make Henri Paul a drunk driver, and that would explain the accident. And, you know, if you look at all the facts there, you'll see that there are a lot of questions about the post-mortem that was done on Henri Paul's body. It looks like samples may have been contaminated, or they may even have been entirely switched with another, a suicide victim, actually, someone who died from a suicide. So all that stuff is very well documented, and the questions remain unanswered. You know, Henri Paul's alcoholism was never fully confirmed, and it looks like simply a ruse. It doesn't appear that he was driving drunk. If you analyze the film, which is available, in fact, I believe that the Scott Baker inquest, most of the materials are still online.
Right. Wasn't that where Henri Paul, supposedly so drunk, bends over to tie his own shoes
exactly
just before walking out, and there's
and he did it
stumbling,
perfectly.
No bumbling.
Doesn't,
right.
Doesn't stagger, nothing. He tied a shoelace, and then he just bounced up and walked around. There's also film of him coming downstairs without tripping. I mean, he was not visibly drunk at all. The bodyguards claim, you know, they would never have allowed Diana to get into the car had Henri Paul been drunk. But it was unusual because Henri Paul was not the usual driver. He was the Ritz security officer. So the implication was that maybe he was paid by assassins who wanted the opportunity. He wouldn't have known that the assassination was going to take place. He may have been told, you know, and here you're theorizing a little bit, but he may have been told, you know, that somebody just wanted pictures or they wanted them to go in this direction. You know, Paris, right. Paris is actually a fairly easy city to get around, and there were lots of different routes going back to Henri Paul's apartment. But they knew that they were going back to the apartment. That was an open secret. Diana and Dodie had been to Paris before, and just about the only places they went were the Ritz and Dodie's apartment and the airport. So, right. You know, it was a no-brainer about where they were going that night. And it would have been Yes.
Let's take a break. We'll come back. We've got to get through some phone calls, some questions. We'll do that when we return on Coast to Coast AM. We're back. This is Coast to Coast AM. Are you ready to field a few phone calls and some questions here?
Sure.
All right. Let's go to Wildcard Line 1, John in Webster City, Iowa. Welcome to the show.
I appreciate the way you two set it up in the beginning of the show. You were talking about the legal anthropology of royalty getting sacrificed whenever something goes wrong with the universe. And
right.
The U.S. was, yeah, that was really nice the way you guys cooperated on that. The U.S. Is the first country to really fully trade the ancient monarchy palace intrigue thing for a tradition of individual responsibility. So in the U.S., the sins of society, we don't necessarily behead princesses or anything, but our scapegoat is supposed to be on a sort of a Judeo-Christian natural law constitutional model. So I wanted to ask you individual responsibility. Does it seem to you like the United States is at a place where we kind of want to, from your legal anthropological studies, it seemed like the U.S. sort of wants to, half of us want to go back to doing things the way Europe and the rest of the world did for centuries. Are we just going to sort of purge the deep state and keep it American? Is it like a Tories versus Patriots thing? Can you the contrast, the human nature, like the traditions of Europe and the U.S.? So thank you. I'll take it off the air. Thanks, guys.
Thank you for listening.
That's a really interesting question. John raises a lot of good points. You know, first, I want to say that, you know, America has had dynasties, even though we're technically against them. I mean, you know, you have the Bush presidencies, which are also, they're often called dynasties. You have Kennedy, the Kennedy family, and its political dynasty. And you also have, you know, the Kennedy assassinations of Robert and John. So there are parallels to be drawn with kingship. Huey Long was the governor of Louisiana. His nickname was the Kingfish, and he had a saying, "Every man a king." And, you know, he wanted to vie with Roosevelt for the presidency, and he was assassinated he was actually killed by his doctors. He was shot by a lone assassin, supposedly, I believe, a doctor. And, you know, it's a very curious story. It's never really been fully sorted out. But I do think, at its heart, Americans, you know, we are patriots. You know, and you see this in the Second Amendment rights and, you know, how deeply divided Americans now are over this right. But I think fundamentally, we believe we have a right to protect ourselves. We believe we have a right to protect our families. And we had a history where the Redcoats, the British, would come through our houses and tear everything up. And so now we have a right to be secure in our homes against illegal search and seizure. These are rights that are taken very seriously. And I think that the British mindset and the European mindset is very different. And of course, you know, you bring up issues of globalism, you know, and the United States is wrestling with that as well, globalism versus nationalism. And these things have cycles. I mean, but we are certainly now bending, you know, much more towards nationalism. But that's the essence of Trump's plan to make America great again. He doesn't say make the world great again. You make America great again, and then the world follows. And I think historically, that's how America has always viewed it. If America is strong, the world will be stronger. And but he, John raises some great points.
All right, let's go to wildcard line two. Bonnie in Las Vegas, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Gosh, I don't know where to start. I've got so much to say here. But I called in about a year ago about this very subject on the show, and George was on one night. And because I had seen a series of shows that talked about her life, and one of them was called Harry the Spare. And at the beginning of this show, it showed a flash of the accident. And it was a really quick flash across the screen, and there was something about it that caught my eye. So I paused it, and I walked up to the screen and looked very closely and saw in the front of it, right next to the crumpled up car, a very large, very vicious looking dog. And next to the dog stood a man that appeared to be holding a leash. And the man was thin with dark hair. And then I remembered there were some other things that I noticed that I brought up in this show. But one of the things I remembered when I saw that was that when the accident happened in 1997, I was very I watched all of the post interviews. And that's usually when you get your best information. You know, you get all the people who saw or were right at the scene that they were interviewed. And one of the men that were at the scene did an interview, and he said he walked out of his car and he walked over to that car. And he said that there was a man in the car with a large dog. And he said that as he was approaching the car, the man and the dog took off. And that when he got to the car, that the princesses, he looked in the car and he saw that her face was torn and that she was bleeding profusely. And then that was that they pulled, he said that some doctors or some ambulance people came up and pulled him away and told him he had to go. Well, when I saw this series of shows last year, then it talked about this Fiat, and they did the investigation. I think it's what you're referring to as the Baker investigation.
Right.
They tracked down this Fiat guy, and he owned a dog. You know, without getting into all of that, the point is that I was able to figure out exactly what happened. And unfortunately, it's much more complicated than what we're hearing with all the details of the medicals, because in that same picture that I saw, there was also a woman in the front, a woman on the left side in the front, and a child in the middle. And the car was smashed down, and the woman on the right was clearly the princess. And the woman on the left was clearly Mother Teresa. And I brought this up, you know, on the show, and you know, I didn't get to finish what I was saying, but it's been very obvious to me that Princess Diana, the person that was with Dodi Fayed, was a double. And her face was torn up by a dog purposefully so that she would not be, it would not be questioned. And the actual accident that killed Princess Diana was long before that, because there was another interview of a nurse at the hospital in Paris who said that when they arrived and got her body, okay, that so much rigor mortis was in her body that she would have had to have been dead for several days, and if not more likely weeks. And that nurse was silenced after that. You never heard from her again. Okay, and so she said that there was no way that accident happened that day that killed her. And according to the book that reads The Murder of Princess Diana, which I read some years ago, there were two cars that pulled up to that hospital. The paparazzi followed them. Then there was all this shuffling. When I'm saying two cars, I mean two ambulances, okay? One ambulance pulled up. There was all this shuffling going on back and forth between the other one. There was two. One of them went to that hospital, and the other one went to another hospital across town. So what really happened was that the actual princess, who had died long earlier with Mother Teresa, had been taken to that hospital, her body already having rigor mortis. The other girl, the double, who was with Dodi Fayed, and the reason why they put her with Dodi Fayed, you know, they had that whole relationship happen to, was so that the Brits, they were hoping that that it would cause so much animosity with the Brits that they wouldn't care by the time that she was killed, because they figured that since he was Muslim that they would just turn on her. But it didn't work. Okay, so that
all right,
when
Bonnie, well, thank you. We've got to wrap it up because we've only got a few minutes left with the guests. Thank you for weighing in on your points. Did any of what Bonnie say fit any kind of the paradigm you've investigated?
Certainly, just like you were talking about Paul McCartney early on, there were rumors, you know, that Diana hadn't really died, that she wanted a vacation, so she basically faked the death, or, you know, that she had died previously and they had a double. There's usually, you know, this kind of rumor gets around. The thing with the dog is partly true. The driver of the white Fiat Uno, I believe, was a royal photographer named James Anderson, who also was likely a contract worker for British intelligence services. He was a very shadowy kind of figure, and he did have a dog. He also owned a white Fiat Uno. When the French got the paint scrape on the Mercedes, they ran around and, you know, they did a spectrum analysis of the paint, and they could pinpoint what years the Fiat had been manufactured. And so they started looking for white Fiat Unos from that period of years where the white paint would have been used. And because each paint on a car has a very specific spectrum composition. And they managed to locate a Vietnamese man who did also have a dog, but the French never prosecuted him, and I don't think that the French believed that the Vietnamese was the driver. I think evidence strongly points to the fact that James Anderson drove the car that caused the crash. And in fact, he left town immediately. He flew to Corsica a few hours after the accident. And in fact, the French started investigating him and his family. They made inconsistent statements to the police. And a few months later, James Anderson was found burned to death in another vehicle in France, in a military field where they do military testing. He was burned to death. A fireman who came to the burning car saw Anderson's body before it burnt. The car was locked. They couldn't open it. And he said he saw two bullet holes in Anderson's head. He's been criticized for this. Some people say, well, you know, when your body gets a certain temperature, you know, your brain will burst out of your head and it will cause, you know, like a bullet hole. And the fireman said, no, I've been a fireman a long time. I've seen people shot. I've attended, you know, gunshot victims, and this was a gunshot. So, you know, it's a mystery. There's probably a lot of things we'll never know. We do know that after Anderson was killed, his office was raided, and the only thing stolen was his hard drive. And, you know, the lady was talking about, Bonnie was talking about photographs, but there are actually very few photographs that were ever released of the accident, even though thousands were taken. All those photographs were confiscated by the French police, and others that were in the possession of photo editors, their houses were robbed and their computers and hard drives stolen.
That's unbelievable. This stuff's outlined. You can check out the book for yourself. Sarah Whalen, thank you so much for joining us. Royal Vengeance, The Assassination of Princess Diana and the Ancient Royal Cult of Human Sacrifice. Hope that gave you something to think about. We'll be back as things go viral here on Coast to Coast AM.